The unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect truth is seldom met with, even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it. We can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Homage to the Buddha. Homage to the Dharma. Homage to the Sangha. How wonderful to see you all this morning. Here we are at the Achalanata ceremony. It's the beginning of the fire season, isn't it? You know, we need to make our own connections between the fires that are raging outside and the ones within. This is our spiritual work. So this is Achalanata in this shrine. He is one of the fierce deities in our tradition. He is called the immovable one, the undisturbed one. He is the king of light. Sometimes he's called a bodhisattva, sometimes a Buddha. He's a direct emanation of Vairochana. Ah, who is now on the altar, and Achalanata is right in his lap. So that's perfect. His sitting place is in the center of the mandala of the fierce lords of light. He's the protector of the temple and the trainees. He's a guardian. He's a guardian. He holds out his light. He represents the will to train, the power of that will, and we can see it in his posture. He is sitting still in the flames of greed, hate, and delusion. And he is showing us the power of meditation within that. He's also a form of Avalokiteshvara, who represents compassion, and this is her shrine. Now, I'm going to tell you this story that we tell every few months here of how Achalanata came to be. I think it's important that we keep hearing it, because if you want to do what he's going to do, then you have to do what she does. And this is sometimes hard to bring together. I'm hoping that we can make some connections here this morning with that. So the story of Achalanata is that Avalokiteshvara, this was before he came into being. So Avalokiteshvara made a vow to save all beings. And if he, she, broke his vow, his body would shatter into 1,000 pieces. After eons of helping people through loving kindness, he looked down on the world and he saw the same amount of suffering. Same old, same old, same old. And he thought he had broken his vow. And his body shattered into 1,000 pieces. Amida Buddha put him back together again, and each piece became an arm. So one of those wonderful 1,000-armed Avalokiteshvaras with hands outstretched and an eye in the palm of every hand to enable her to see, to look around and see suffering wherever it was and see how to help. And so now Avalokiteshvara could offer help everywhere, and Achalanata sprang forth from her heart to offer help to those who need a more direct approach. I'm sorry, I'm one of those, so I really understand this. Not everyone can make use of gentleness and kindness. So sometimes we need a knock on the head to actually recognize that help is being offered. You know, if you're in white water over your head and you've fallen out of your boat, you're going down in a swift current and a log comes by, hits you over the head, you may recognize this. Ah, this is something I could hold on to. And it'll take me to the other shore. So when we actually can see a chalanata appear, then we can make use of what it is that he is pointing out to us. One of the great joys of Buddhism is that the Buddhas and ancestors appear in any form that's going to help us. Could be your neighbor, could be your dog, could be your partner, you know? We get a fleeting glimpse, Chalanata, Avalokiteshvara, turn up all the time. I mean, truly, our work is to learn how to recognize him, her, it, because constantly appearing. Reverend Master Koten likes to say the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are constantly appearing and there isn't anything anybody can do about it. So I've always been interested in how many people who don't know a thing about Buddhism really understand what's going on here. When I've given tours, you know, to people who come, take them into the shrine, you explain a chalanata is sitting still in the flames of greed, hate, and delusion. You know, it looks like hell. We've created our own hell. People say, yeah. You know, it's part of us really understands that intuitively. So he is sitting on a rock, and it is rock solid. He is grounding himself in his meditation. And, you know, we use that term a lot, and that's why we spend a lot of time trying to help people get a firm meditation position so they can actually sit still and start dealing with what's going on in their minds. So, you know, sometimes it's good just to put both your feet flat on the ground and ground yourself. You can do that anytime that you feel you need some help. Planting your feet firmly on the ground, and that's what he's showing us. And he isn't doing it, actually. He's not doing that sitting for us. He's doing it for himself, and he is an example for us as to what it is that we can do. He is pointing to the sitting place that we each have within ourselves. He's not running around trying to fix things. He's not doing stuff. He is being still and allowing what needs to come forth to come forth. He trusts that there is that which will come forth if we can simply allow it to, if we can quiet ourselves down. You know, those of us who have been here for a few days during this retreat, this has been one of the themes, to allow what is within to emerge and to entrust ourselves to that. So the word defilements is used in some of these scriptures. And that sounds like a pretty heavy word, and it kind of puts people off, you know, especially because there isn't a lot of description about what it means. But my understanding of it is that it is whatever we are putting in between our relationship. What are we putting between ourselves and our relationship with our Buddha nature? In other words, when you sit down on your cushion or when you're standing up, what's coming up? What's in the way? What's in the way? And usually what it is some form of greed, hate, and delusion. Now, Reverend Master Jiu, I remember, you know, very early on, and some of you who were there at those early lectures will remember, she used to talk about everybody comes to training with a good, healthy swatch of greed, hate, and delusion. And she said it with a big smile on her face. And so right there, you know, right there was the acceptance of the fact that we all have it. And she knew it. And it's part of the human condition. So, you know, right from the beginning, she would put us at ease with our humanity. The thing is, we keep forgetting it. I was just remembering this morning, oh, not too awfully long ago, I said, was telling Reverend Master Daishin about something I had done that I felt really badly about, and I was going on and on about it. And he looked at me and he said, "Kodo, you're a human being." And before I could even think, I said, "Oh, I hate that." Now, truly, that's funny, but you know, it's true. I can feel myself turning red probably. Because really, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about that. So anyway, the point was that was the starting point for Reverend Master Jiu with us. This is what we've got, and this is what we're going to work with. And we are going to convert the energy of greed, hate, and delusion. That was back in the 70s. The recycling movement was just getting going. She said, "This is the most encouraging spiritual movement I have seen in this country, because we are recognizing that we cannot get rid of anything." And boy, isn't that true now? Isn't that what we are dealing with? All these things that we are doing in the environment are reminding us, no, we can't. We have to be able to find a way to recycle, to reuse, to make use of these things. And you know, this is what she was such a master at, because she saw the Buddha nature in everything. She saw the boundless potential in everything and everyone that she looked at. That is what she saw. Look, that's why we're here today. That's why we're here today, because she took us from that starting place of greed, hate, and delusion, and told us that we could make this our spiritual practice. And we do. And our business really is to hold out our faith that it can be done. And there's a great deal of joy in doing it. So, Achalanata in his left hand is holding out the rope of the precepts with which to bind all evil forces. Now, in Buddhism, there isn't anything inherently evil out there. In Buddhism, we talk about evil as that which causes suffering. So the precepts are a way of liberating us from suffering. They are pointing to those things that we do that cause suffering. He's holding this out to us. He's giving us a choice, and we are the ones who can make the choice. The rope signifies restraint. It signifies refraining. Now, in the invocation that we sang in praise of Achalanata, the words written by Reverend Master Sekai, and he has a wonderful feeling for Achalanata, I think. He describes him as restraining and converting all forms of intoxicating desire and angry intentions. So, again, the energy of those passions gets transformed or recycled, in our current language, into something useful in the fires of purification. And he goes on to say, he is unafraid to enter into foul-smelling places, ripe with defilement, there to do all that needs to be done to cleanse away filth and corruption. Now, he's just calling a spade, isn't he? Foul-smelling places ripe with defilement. I think that's a wonderful description. Something about that, I think, is very just really clarifying. You know, he's not talking about the flesh pots that we think about. in the Bay Area or Las Vegas or New York City. You know, he's talking about our own minds and what we get up to. And that's why we need to keep in mind Avalokiteshvara when we do this work, because truly, if we are going to be willing to have a look at what is really there, then we are going to have to do it with the mind of compassion and actually be able to see the purity at the heart of all of it. So Achalanata is looking with compassion and seeing how he can help us. The invocation talks about beings entertaining despair. I think that's an interesting choice of words. They're entertaining despair. You know, they're not just experiencing it, but they're actually entertaining it. So they've invited it in. They're hanging out with despair, really. And that aspect of choice that we have. And then he uses the word wallow in hopelessness. Again, that's a choice, because, you know, we all feel hopeless from time to time. And we can either dig in our heels or we can find another way to work with that. Now, the precepts that we looked at during this retreat are in Dogen's language. He puts the precepts in the language of refraining. They're not always talked about that way. There are other versions of it. I have always been drawn to the simplicity of refraining. You know, before we got interested in Buddhism, we all did pretty much what we wanted to do, didn't we? We found out it wasn't all that terrific. And we thought, gee, maybe there's another way. You know, maybe there is another way. And we can trust our hearts that there is another way. And we can refrain from the things that the precepts tell us cause suffering. The three pure precepts: cease from evil, do only good, and do good for others. It's a good place to start. Because cease from evil, it's really hard often to know what's good to do. Often it's a lot clearer about what's good not to do. And I would not underestimate for a moment the value of not doing, if that's what comes up. Remember, Master Jiu used to have a bumper sticker on her car that said, don't just do something, sit there. All right. Now, I'm not speaking against doing something useful. I think we all know what that means, how many times we've done something hoping it would be helpful. I was mentioning yesterday in the agency that I worked for, it was a social agency, we had a banner on the wall that said, "The helping hand strikes again." So just seeing when it's good to step back can be a real form of ceasing from evil. Now, I have often talked about this mantra that Reverend Master Jiu taught us when she got back from Japan. In fact, you're probably tired of hearing me talk about it. I could be wrong. But you know, I found in volume 2 of Roar of the Tigress, in her chapter on the All is One and the All is Different, she says, "I could be wrong" is actually another version of the three pure precepts. It's not just an expression. She said, when we say I could be wrong, we could be ignoring. We could be ignorant of something. We could be ignoring that there is an unborn. We could be ignoring karmic consequence. So the thing about being able to say I could be wrong is if you tack it on the end of something you're saying, especially a strong opinion, you kind of get an inner jolt. And if you experiment with it, you can see the effect that it has. Now, during this last few days, we talked a lot about seeing things, seeing the all is one and the all is different. There were many people here all talking about different ways of looking at the same thing. And it was really, really a very powerful eye-opener. I could hear people saying, and I said it myself. Oh, yeah, I hadn't thought of that, you know. So it's something that goes on all the time. And we don't necessarily need to have somebody else there. We can just make that suggestion to ourselves if we feel something coming up. Yeah, that could be right. Yeah, but I could be wrong. I could be wrong. Because the whole matter of delusion is a tricky business. Because, of course, if you're deluded, you don't necessarily see that you are. So that's the hard part. Yeah, that's why there's a piece in one of our verses talking about, you know, we ask that the light of the Buddha pierce the darkness of the streets of delusion. Streets of delusion are dark. They're dark. Sometimes people ask about how to train with the distraction of the internet and all the electronic devices that are proliferating, and how to discern what part of this may be another form of delusion. One of our precepts is do not sell the wine of delusion. And it's talking about intoxicants, of which there are many kinds besides drugs and alcohol. Many kinds. And of course, the essence of delusion is that we don't see clearly. Now, I want to read something that some of you may be familiar with, but there was a study that was published in the San Francisco Chronicle sometime here in the last year or so. And I just want to read you a couple of paragraphs from it. It is entitled, It's Hard to Be Alone with Your Thoughts. Now, actually, someone actually said, a young man who was in his late 20s, was very successful, made a very successful life in terms of, you know, what society's expectations. He had a really good job. He had a lot of money, had a very beautiful house, and he confided to a friend of his that with all of that, his deepest, darkest fear was being alone in a room with himself and no distractions. So this study says, have you heard about the story about a new study purporting to show that people prefer being shocked with electricity to being left alone with their own thoughts? They did a study. The one that got the most attention was the one that hooked subject up to electrical wires. Fully a quarter of the women and two-thirds of the men zapped themselves rather than sit silently and do nothing at all. Most subjects shocked themselves around 7 times in a period of about 6 minutes. Now, the woman who wrote this article said, you know, when she first read this, she was feeling kind of smug and thinking, well, what does that have to do with me? You know, I mean, it just sounds so outrageous when you hear about it. But she said, during the course of writing this column, I checked Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, and Gmail at least 3 times apiece while she's writing this article. In fact, I'll admit that for longer projects, my productivity is dependent on the internet blocking software program called Freedom. I have recommended it to more than a dozen people, all who have admitted the same thing. So there is a similarity there. And it's funny and it's sad. It's very sad. And I realize, actually, when I teach meditation, I often just say, you know, what it boils down to is being able to sit in a room with ourselves. And this is where Avalokiteshvara comes in. This is where compassion comes in. We had been talking during several previous days about the three refuges and meditation as coming back home, this feeling of coming back home to something that we have always known. And the fact that we keep running away from home, right? We keep running away from home. Basically, we keep trying to get away from ourselves. And as Dogen says, you know, it's futile to travel to other dusty countries forsaking your own seat. And as I was mentioning yesterday, I heard that word forsaking the first time. Because actually, it's the same thing, isn't it? We are running away from our own seat. He's talking about our seat being our meditation place, our own heart. We're forsaking it, we're turning away from it. It's futile to do that. And then he said, already you have the attributes of a human being. Now, I've been reading this scripture probably 43 years, and that human, that's always kind of niggled, you know, I always read over it, but all of a sudden it dawned on me, actually this morning, oh, he's saying, already you have the attributes of human being. And then he says, do not waste time with this and that. You can possess the authority of Buddha. Those two things don't stand against one another. You're a human being. You can possess the authority of Buddha. I finally put them together. Because really, my understanding of possessing the authority of Buddha is possessing the certainty that we have Buddha nature within our own hearts. And if we are human beings, we already have the attributes that we need to do that. And isn't that what Reverend Master Gio told us right from the first day? You can do this, she said. And there was never, ever, ever the slightest doubt. So, this business of trying to get away from our humanness is the wine of delusion. So Reb Anderson, in his book on the precepts, he's written a really quite wonderful book called Being Upright, Zen Meditation and the Bodhisattva Precepts. He uses this image of being upright, meaning that when we are upright, we are aligning ourselves with the Buddha and ancestors. We are putting ourselves in line with our Buddha nature. And this powerful image he returns to repeatedly in his book. And I would like to read his commentary on the precept, do not sell the wine of delusion. So he has a slightly different way of talking about it. It's quite wonderful. He says everything is inviable. Inviable. Everything is inherently pure. And then under it, it says no intoxicants. And this is what Dogen says. When nothing can be brought in, everything is inviable. This is exactly the great brightness. And then he says, the precept of not intoxicating the mind or body of self or others is for all of us who have difficulty remaining upright in the midst of our suffering. It encourages us to trust being upright instead of using intoxicants as the best way to deal with our restlessness, anxiety, and pain. Isn't that what he is pointing to? In the turbulence of our changing lives with their waves of pain and pleasure, it's difficult to be quiet and still. But as Dogen says, here is the place, here the way unfolds. Without any tampering, and this is again Reb Anderson, without any tampering or manipulation of what is happening, the way of freedom unfolds here. The word intoxicate means to poison. In the broadest sense, anything we ingest, inhale, or inject into our system without reverence for all life becomes an intoxicant. Whether we speak of intoxication or substance abuse, the essential issue here is that we are dissatisfied with our current experience. We may dislike or feel bored with our experience and wish to bring something in to change or end it. We may be fairly satisfied with our experience, but we want to bring something in to modify it a little. Or we may enjoy our experience and bring something in to prolong or intensify it. Because we anticipate that it will not last. All of these examples share a common thread, a lack of appreciation for life and for what we have. And then he says, the impulse to abuse has to be graciously uprooted from some deeper place. You need to understand how the impulse to change your state arises. This impulse to modify and manipulate and thus abuse your precious life comes from turning away from what Dogen calls the great brightness of your being. In this great brightness, nothing can be brought in. Being upright with this great brightness, you have no desire to bring something in. This is the attitude of mind that we need to bring to our meditation cushion so we can do the kind of work that Achalanata is inviting us to do. Now, I want to share something else with you because some people have difficulty sitting physically. And sometimes we're not feeling very well. And we may feel that we can't sit for one reason or another. And I think this very gentle approach does not stand against the message of that wonderful iconography there. But this is something that Reverend Master Koten, who is the prior at Dragon Flower where's Dragon Flower? Thank you. It's in British Columbia. Yeah. It's from Lion's Gate Buddhist Priory up in Lytton, and it's a, something that he put out. It's called How to Meditate Without Sitting Down. I've been asked to write something about meditation for those who are unable to sit physically in any comfortable way, or those who have a lot of have to spend a lot of time in bed. In considering this, I found myself, much to my surprise, wanting to talk first of all about precepts. That is, starting with do no harm. While you are lying there or trying to go about your day, make a determination. Begin the morning with a commitment to try and do no harm. Speak no harm, think no harm, wish no harm. When you are distracted, worried, in pain, discouraged, come back to do no harm. Remind yourself that what you are unable to, that whatever else you are unable to do, you can do that, and that in itself is something useful. Now, I want to say that that goes a heck of a lot further than being useful, and Reverend Master Koten, I think, is understating it. I hope he won't mind if I say that. But when we do no harm, even if we're lying in bed, the merit of that is beyond anything that we can imagine, whether or not we can see it. Next, try to let go of the unnecessary, such as worry over the news. The world will go on without you. Leave it be when it gets overwhelming. Let go of family quarrels. You can't take them with you into the next world. Try practicing for several days. There should be more calm. Explore this calm. When you experience a calm moment throughout the day, stop whatever you are doing and rest in it. Take refuge in it. Trust it. It is a door. So I would add that I think this is really good advice, even if you're up and running. Some days are really difficult for us, and because of the conditions, we may not be able to do what we wanted to do or what we thought would be good to do or whatever, but we can always come back to do no harm. And no effort is ever wasted. So I think that's good advice. So here in the monastery, we ask for Achalanata's help every night. And we need to open ourselves to receiving it. Because that's the way this works. We have to ask for help before we can actually receive it. Not because we're not always getting it, but because we don't really realize that we are until we're ready. So that asking is a sign that we are ready to receive what is being offered. And the Heavenly Guardian goes around in the evening. And some of you may have seen bits and pieces of this Heavenly Guardian. We come in and do a ceremony here. And we ask for Achalanata's help during the night. We ask him for a peaceful night, and we ask him to protect us basically from various forms of delusion and that which can get in the way, and help us to actually be able to make use of the night for our training. And Vespers helps us with that. It puts us in the mind of meditation when we go to bed with that intention in our mind, and then we walk into the meditation hall and bless the hall and those who are sleeping there, and then we walk around the temple and we bless the temple and we bless the gates. And when we are circumambulating and walking around the temple, we recite a Dharani, which is Mambo Kojin, the fierce protector of the three treasures. He was the protector of the temple that he is the protector of the temple where Reverend Master Jiu trained, and he is now the protector here as well. He does more than one thing. He's got a lot of jobs. He is our protector, and we call on him when we walk around the temple. And the Dharani is one that you have heard before. It's Om Kembaya, Kembaya, Umbata Soaka. Now, the interesting thing is the translation of this Dharani is not dispelling evil. It is dispelling fear and terror. So that is what we are working with. A monk once said to me, there's nothing to be afraid of except those parts of ourself that we have not yet accepted. And that's what we put out there. So the fear and terror is a way of looking within and rooting ourselves in our meditation place. And that is the place where there is nothing to fear, because in the deepest sense, nothing can harm us when we are in that place. Now, I would like to end with a story that I think some of you have heard before, but because of everything that's going on in the world right now, I think this is a very fitting and encouraging story, and is really the essence of Achalanata's teaching. This is a story that Venerable Thich Nhat Hanh tells when he was a young monk and he befriended a French soldier in Vietnam during the Vietnam War. He says, "We sat down near the pump house, and he told me about the visit that he and five other soldiers had made 10 days earlier to Bao Qua Temple. They went to the temple at 10 o'clock at night in search of Vietnamese resistors who were reportedly gathering at the temple." And the soldier says, "We were determined to find them. We carried guns. The orders were to arrest and even kill if necessary. But when we entered the temple, we were utterly shocked." It sounded very strange, so he asked the question, "Well, what shocked you?" And the soldier said, "But what happened this time was so unexpected. Wherever we did searches in the past, people would run away or be thrown into a state of panic. When we entered the temple," he continued, "it was like entering a deserted place. The oil lamps were turned very low. It was completely silent. We purposely stomped our feet loudly on the gravel, but there was no other sound. I had the feeling there were many people in the temple, but it was completely quiet, aside from the ticking of a clock that was hanging nearby. The shouting of a comrade made me uneasy. Nobody made a reply. I pointed my flashlight into the empty room, and before our eyes appeared a solemn scene of 50 or 60 monks sitting still and silently in meditation. It was like we ran into a strange and invisible force," he said. "It scared us so much that we turned and left the temple." The monks just ignored us. They didn't raise a voice in reply, and they didn't show any signs of panic or fear. And Thich Nhat Hanh says, well, they weren't ignoring you. They were practicing concentrating on their breath. That was all. And the soldier said, we ourselves were attracted to their calmness. It was worthy of our respect. We stood silently in the temple's courtyard at the foot of a large tree, and we waited for perhaps half an hour. There were a series of bells that sounded, and then the temple returned to normal activity. A monk lit a torch and came to invite us inside. But we simply told him why we were there and then asked to leave. From that day on, I began to change my ideas about the Vietnamese people. So I would like to end there. I would like to dedicate the merit of this retreat to Reverend Master Jiu. Whose legacy was and will be to hold out her faith to us that we can find the truth within our own hearts and that we can help others do the same.